I'm Wade Keller, editor and publisher of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter and former host here at PW Torch Livecast. If you're looking for my shows, they have moved as of July 2017. They're now called the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, available through Podcast One. Enter Wade Keller on your podcast app or iTunes and subscribe to the new Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, where I cover Raw and my first show of the week, SmackDown with my second show of the week, and then the Flagship Edition with a co-host, and we cover a broad array of pro wrestling current events, and then I end the week with a weekly interview. That's the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, now at Podcast One. Subscribe today. Just search Wade Keller. Welcome to the PW Torch Livecast. I'm Wade Keller, not Jim Valley. This is a special edition of the Wednesday Nostalgia Cast, normally Wrestling Road Stories with Jim Valley. But today, we're going to give you a free sample. Well, Jim Valley is on assignment. We'll give you a free sample of a recent special VIP podcast with Bruce Mitchell and Britt Whitmire. A great follow-up to last week's Wrestling Road Stories with Jim Valley. This is Bruce and Britt, no two better people to talk about this, discussing Starrcade 1987. Starrcade 87. And this is a first half of their marathon conversation. It went 140 minutes. So that's well over 2 hours, discussing in depth the final Thanksgiving edition, the final Ric Flair on Thanksgiving on pay-per-view edition of Starrcade. If you love this discussion and you want to listen to the second half, it is available in the Bruce Mitchell audio show section. As a VIP member, you have access to that. And you can go VIP right now, pwtorch.com/goVIP. That's pwtorch.com/goVIP. There are a lot of wrestling podcasts out there for free. There is nothing that matches the wide array of top shelf, next level wrestling analysis of the current scene and nostalgia than the massive library of content and the new content being added every single day at PW Torch VIP. Don't miss out. Be part of it. It is pwtorch.com/goVIP. That's the page you go to get bullet points on what comes with the VIP membership and sign up. It's mobile friendly, desktop friendly. Our podcasts are available on popular podcast apps on iPhone and Android. You can also stream our podcasts straight from our ad-free VIP mobile and desktop websites. So join us, won't you? pwtorch.com/goVIP. Here we go. It is time for Bruce Mitchell and Britt Whitmire with a special edition of our Wednesday Nostalgia Cast here at PW Torch Livecast. Tomorrow, Mike McMahon and Andrew Socek take over to talk about Impact Wrestling. Friday, it'll be the best of PW Torch Livecast. Saturday, the deep dive with Rich Fan. And then Wrestling Night in America comes back on Sunday night with Pat McNeil and Greg Parks, looking ahead to Clash of Champions. Looking back at some recent big events, they will focus primarily on pro wrestling's big shows, and they usually have a special guest who joins them. And then Monday, it'll be right back for MMA talk for pro wrestling fans. We appreciate your support for the PW Torch Livecast, and here we go, Bruce and Britt on Starrcade 87. Enjoy.
This is the historical discussion of Starrcade 87, which took place November 26, 1987, at the UIC Pavilion in Chicago, Illinois, with your main event, Ron Garvin, Hands of Stone, the NWA World Heavyweight Champion, defending his title against the former champion, the Nature Boy, Ric Flair. My name is Britt Whitmire, and I am the co-host of the wrestling podcast, Katie Vick is Alive Alive, which is available anywhere you get podcasts, and I'm also the co-host of the non-wrestling podcast, the Brad and Britt Podcast, which, again, is available anywhere you get podcasts. And here he is, ladies and gentlemen, the Torch, pwtorch.com and Pro Wrestling Torch senior columnist and Bruce Pritchard's favorite analyst. Here he is, Bruce Mitchell.
You know, this gives you an idea of how apt I was and have been as a wrestling fan and analyst. I went to this show. This is the only Starcade I ever attended because, as we were talking off the air, my Thanksgiving is a big night for my – not big night, but big day for my family. And,
right.
and it's unusual for one of us to either to skip it or to miss any part of it. So, but I just said, screw it. I'm going to Starcade. The problem is, as you just said, Starcade was in Chicago, and I went to Greensboro. it was raining, cold, rainy, nasty. Drove an hour and a half to Greensboro, and they had it on closed circuit. But they also had bonus matches.
Oh, wow.
They had bonus matches before the show started, which with such stars, or at least the only two that I remember, Kevin Sullivan, which we liked Kevin Sullivan. I liked Kevin Sullivan. But he just had come back, and he hadn't started the – I don't know if he'd started the Varsity Club or whatever it was. But, nah, yeah, he probably had by then. But anyway, but he wasn't – he had a singles match, and then an all-time classic wrestler, the Mighty Wilbur.
Wow.
Those were the two standouts in the three matches that preceded Starcade for the live audience. And then we watched it on a big screen up at the top of the Greensboro Coliseum. So that is one of those things where if I could go back in a time machine, I would be estranged from my family and I would be Starcade on Thanksgiving. And also I would not be a high school graduate because I'd be instead of like going to high school, I would be attending the Tuesday night WRAL Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling tapings. And so, I don't know where I'd be right now. Probably I'd be a millionaire or something. But anyway, if I could go back, those are my two big regrets in life.
So. Now remind me, was Mighty Wilbur, was he working the Haystacks Calhoun gimmick?
Yes, Mighty Wilbur was the plucky but not so bright hillbilly that Paul Jones and his recruited into his army sight unseen, and then realized what he'd gotten, this naive big guy who wouldn't do anything that was crooked, and so but was nice about it and called Paul Jones Puddinhead. And as hillbilly gimmicks go, Mighty Wilbur was fat. They always are fat, and
yes,
but remarkably short, as I recall. And this was about as dud a character as you saw during Dusty Rhodes's booking of Crockett Promotions. This was so anyway. He didn't make the main, as we'll talk about, the main roster of Starcade this year.
This is the part of the show that where I make Bruce and me and Wade and anybody who's of a certain age feel pretty old. Here's what was happening back in 1987. Average price of a gallon of gasoline was $1.07, which sounds pretty cheap. But if you go ahead and use your inflation calculator, that's about $2.27 a gallon, and I can get that pretty close, at least near my house here in North Carolina. Other people may have to pay a lot more. Here's a big one. A gallon of milk would run you $1.98, and that's $4.21 in 2017 money. So there's plenty of places around here where you can get a gallon of milk for under $3. A loaf of bread would cost you $1.28. A brand new car, Bruce, would cost you $7,000 on average, which works out to about $15,000. In today's money, and there's plenty of cars that you can get, decent cars, for $15,000 today. Number one movie of 1987, it was Three Men and a Baby, Ted Danson and Tom Selleck finally breaking through beyond their TV success to have a big box office motion picture that took in $167 million. That would be equivalent to $355 million.
Yeah, but didn't that have that big movie star in it, the great movie star Steve Guttenberg?
Steve Guttenberg was a huge star at that time and did very much carry the movie. That's a good call on that one. Nice catch. Yeah. Number two was Fatal Attraction. I'm not going to be ignored, Dan. Beverly Hills Cop 2 and Good Morning Vietnam, rounding out your top four. Number one song of 1987, I remember this one well, Walk Like an Egyptian by the Bangles.
I saw the Bengals at ACOC Auditorium.
There you go.
Yeah, the Bengals were good. That was fun. I'm a fan. Yeah.
Would you like to tell all the young people how much you love Susanna Hoffs back in 1987?
Oh, good Lord, yes. Oh, man.
We loved Susanna Hoffs back in 1987. She was.
We did, and she's not all that far off from it today.
That's exactly right. Yeah. She's aged very well.
Talented, beautiful woman. Woo, yeah.
Number one television show. Would you like to gander a guess as to what the number one TV show of 1987 was?
Cheers.
Don't think too hard. You're close. It was on the same night as Cheers, but it was The Cosby Show. And my how things have changed.
Yes. Oh, God. You know, first comedy album I ever bought was Best of Bill Cosby. I was a fan of those comedy albums and all that. And I liked the first year of The Cosby Show until it got a little too sanitary. But now it's just ruined.
The first year of The Cosby Show was very much based on that sitcom stuff or his stand-up stuff.
Right.
It was about the problems that he was having with his kids. And they almost took it directly from, like, Bill Cosby himself, that album.
Yeah, I mean, it's the classic, you know, the classic line, I can make another one look just like you.
I brought you into this world, I can take you out.
Right. I brought you in this world, I can take you out. I can make another one look just like you. Yeah, I mean, that's – but, I mean, you know, and I'm a big believer, we follow the career of Ric Flair and follow the career of wrestlers and all this other stuff of trust the art, not the artist. But there's a certain point where you can't even do that. And with Bill Cosby, I've reached that point. It's just so ugh.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah. Now, if you're under the age of, let's say, 40, you're probably not going to remember. That was a killer Thursday night lineup for NBC. At first, it featured – it was Family Ties and The Cosby Show, and it was Cheers. And then eventually, I think St. Elsewhere was the big capper at 10 o'clock. But it was – they had a killer Thursday night lineup, and it helped – after the early 80s, NBC nearly going dead with Supertrain and such hits as that. They really came back strong.
Fred Silverman. The immortal Fred Silverman, the man with the golden gut. Yeah.
He was good.
He was fun.
Here were the people that were born in 1987. If you'd like to feel really old here with me, Bruce. Okay. Miami Dolphins defensive lineman Ndamukong Suh. This woman, this wrestler that some writer used to call Double Kelly, Barbie Blank, was born in 1987.
Attractive woman, yes.
Movie star Michael B. Jordan, who was in the Fantastic Four and in a great movie called Fruitvale Station, also was on Friday Night Lights. Also Ellen Page, the movie star. She was the star of Juno. MMA's own Ronda Rousey, Rowdy Ronda Rousey, was born in 1987, as well as hip-hop pop superstar Kesha, AJ Lee, San Francisco Giants catcher Buster Posey, Charlotte's own model and movie star Brooklyn Decker, who now lives in the mountains of North Carolina, at least part-time with her husband Andy Roddick, Andy Murray and Novak Djokovic, both tennis greats, born in 1987, rapper Kendrick Lamar, perhaps the greatest college quarterback of all time, Tim Tebow, was born in 1987.
Perhaps.
I said college.
Yes.
Hip-hop superstar Wiz Khalifa and former Disney heartthrob Zac Efron, all people who were born in 1987. Gives you a little flavor of the culture and what was going on in America. Let's concentrate on what was going on with Jim Crockett Promotions and what was happening in the Carolinas and Virginia and their power base. And Bruce, business, as far as I'm reading it, and a lot of my information is coming from the Jim Cornette Midnight Express scrapbook, it looks like 87 was very good for business, and they had a lot of great dates with the Great American Bash.
Number one, that is an excellent book, and Cornette was and is obsessive about record keeping, so he backs up what he says with numbers and you know, telling his stories and all that. That's a cool book. But it was in 87, but it was also the beginning of the end. And you can see it as it comes along. I think in the beginning of 87, they were stronger than by the end. And the Great American Bash Tour had some successes in the summer of 87, but it wasn't as successful as it was in 86. And it was really – and it was packed with even more booking with that. 87 was when the worm began to turn. And I think, you know, I hadn't watched the entire Starrcade from 87 since I saw it. I certainly have seen, Flair and Garvin in the years since. But I really hadn't – and I'd seen Dusty and Luger. But I really hadn't watched the whole thing. And the heat wasn't quite as there. The booking wasn't quite as there. The stars are getting older, and Dusty is over, and you can kind of see it coming across. We've done 83, 84, 85, 86, and they were really hot that are really on it. But and also they moved to all the way to Chicago, where they were doing good business, but it wasn't Starcade wasn't entrenched there the way it was in the Southeast, the way it was in Greensboro, and I'm not even just talking about Thanksgiving night, a tradition in the Greensboro Coliseum, which is why they even ran anything
right
at the Coliseum. It was just that, people would go to wrestling, but they weren't going every month. They weren't going there. And they kind of – this was – the decision to go to Chicago was controversial too. And it showed. And we'll talk about why it being in Chicago was important and the really, really dumb thing they did during this show that ruined that market for them for many years.
I'm looking at some of the these are some of the impressive results. Landover, Maryland, the old Capitol Center – $195,000. That's a record gate. You go to July the 13th at West Palm Beach at the auditorium there. That's a small building, $55,000. That's a record. You go to Roanoke, a record there on the 19th that's $80,000. The UIC Pavilion, which is where they would host Starcade on July the 19th, sold out $136,000. You sprinkle those in with, let's go back to say July the 9th. Cincinnati at the Gardens, that's a $63,000 gate. You go to San Francisco for the Bash on July the 7th, that's a $66,000 gate. The Forum on July the 6th was $85,000. So there was, like you said, in the traditional markets, and Chicago was very hot. We'll talk about that in just a moment as well. But as you say, in the traditional markets where they've done very well, and in a few outside, they did okay. But in some of these places where they were trying to expand so rapidly, they just didn't do very well at all.
Right, right. And I remember you're talking about the gates. I remember buying my ticket for the Greensboro Bash, and we were all up in arms because they charged $50.
Wow.
They charged $50, and it was – they had gotten to, I think, 30 before, and no one was happy with that. But $50, it was like, oh, my God, $50. And when you think of what getting a front row seat at a major WWE show cost 30 years later, it's eye-opening. Although it's good business, the one thing that's been interesting to me to learn all through all these years is in wrestling, and I think in a lot of things it's the high price tickets that go first.
It was
like the higher the price, the people that are going to buy those tickets, they will buy those tickets.
But it's also been, wrestling was always for a number of years until Vince McMahon turned it into a family thing. It was always considered very much a blue collar thing. And $50 back in those days would be the equivalent of about $112 today, which I think that's about what I paid to see the Foo Fighters a few weeks ago. At the Greensboro Coliseum. So you're going – you're kind of going against the natural grain of that blue-collar fan
right.
when you do that sort of thing. But like you said, you got to make the money where you can make the money.
Yeah, and the wrestling promotion has always claimed to be – I always look at it like with Vince McMahon too in WWF. They claim to be family-friendly, but they kind of aren't. They still – they always – whenever I go to a WWE show over the last – many years, it seems like some of the same blue collar demographic. There's some differences, but it's definitely there.
Don't just listen to PW Torch's brand of wrestling coverage. Read it too every day at pwtorch.com. Join me Monday nights for my live coverage of Raw, Tuesday nights for my live coverage of SmackDown, Sunday nights for my live coverage of WWE pay-per-views, and keep up on the news and read exclusive editorials and special features every day at pwtorch.com.
Let's talk about conventional wisdom on this, and let's go ahead and tackle this head-on because I don't think there's any way to kind of go around it. The conventional wisdom on this and what has survived through the years, at least what I've heard, is that this was going to Chicago and holding Starcade 87 in Chicago was considered to be a slap in the face toward the fans in Greensboro. And the Greensboro Coliseum during this era may have been the number one building for professional wrestling in the whole country. There may have been more tickets sold to see wrestling at the Greensboro Coliseum during the entire decade of the 80s than there was maybe in arguably than there was in any other arena in America, depending on how Mid-South was doing at a particular time. I guess that would be something that you could look into. But it was a very hot place.
Yeah, you'd have to wonder about the garden. You'd have to wonder about Madison Square Garden. But
I would say certainly during the Bruno Sammartino, Pedro Morales era, yeah, I would say that they probably outdrew the Greensboro Coliseum. But for that whole decade of the 1980s, and obviously the WWF at that time was resurgent with the addition of Hulk Hogan, Hulkamania, and the stars that were coming in at that time. But it was up there, top three, top four, top five, whatever. The conventional wisdom is that the people in Greensboro and the Carolinas who had seen Greensboro built into this mecca felt slapped in the face by Jim Crockett Promotions, by being abandoned because where the hell is Greensboro? Everybody knows what Chicago is, and that's a big stage. And this was the beginning of killing the town by JCP. Is that correct, Bruce?
It's part of the process, and it was an insult. I don't think it was the crucial insult, but it definitely was kind of taken that way. Greensboro being the biggest arena in the territory back in the 70s and into the 80s, and then in the national expansion, still, very important. They had and drawing big gates. The Great American Bash, where Dusty Rhodes, the year before, where Dusty Rhodes beat Ric Flair in a steel cage for the NWA title, that was a sellout, but that was the last sellout for them. And it was just part of – and I remember going every month, and we'll talk about – when we get to it, we'll talk about the Dusty finish. But there was this frustration among fans of getting shows where they felt ripped off, where they felt like they were getting screwed, and it was mostly by the finishes of getting the rug pulled out from under them, wanted to see the Four Horsemen lose, wanted to see the Midnight Express lose, and they would see that, but they would not lose the belts, and they go back on television and brag, Well, anyway, we'll get to that one. And the theory was that they could, the heels would get beat up in the arenas, and then go back on television. They were such good talkers, and they were, that they would lie and they'd get their heat back. But fans also saw the same pattern over and over again, and they were pissed and they were tired of it. And you literally saw, and then also, I don't think this gets talked about enough, but Dusty Rhodes was overexposed and was. To the point where, years later, talk about the Great Four Horsemen and all that, and they were, but part of why the Four Horsemen was so popular was people were tired of Dusty Rhodes, and the Horsemen were cooler and all that, but Dusty, as the booker and the main power in the promotion, responded by making things about him even more and overexposing himself even more. So he and physically, he was losing what little athletic talent that he had through age and through being overweight. And so it was just, I remember walking out of the Coliseum month after month and people around me going, screw that, I've had enough. And it really was a lesson, because you went from sellout to 10,000 to for the return of Magnum TA and the $100,000 to 8,000 to 6,000 to 5,000. It was just incremental, not even incrementally, but chunk after chunk going down. And then when we look at this whole show, there's problems in the booking too, and there's problems with there's problems with the talent level being stale other places too. So it was they had the hot run and then they didn't adjust, and this is where they start not adjusting, not freshening things up, and frankly not getting rid of Dusty Rhodes.
The other piece of conventional wisdom that survived for 30 years has been like, okay, you got Chicago, third largest market in America, obviously huge population. It's going to be on a national stage. Why did you pick the UIC Pavilion? Arguably the third most important arena in Chicagoland. Why didn't you pick Chicago Stadium or the Rosemont Horizon? And conventional wisdom over these years has always said, well, all right, fine, they picked Chicago, but they really made a bonehead decision in picking the UIC Pavilion. What do you say about that, Bruce?
I don't know if it was a bonehead decision. I think it was the best that they could do, because number one, it was a new market, and there's only so far expense they wanted to go. But back in those days, the arenas were run in a certain kind of like the mafia in certain ways. And if the WWF was entrenched in an arena, it was hard to break through. You look at Madison Square Garden as the classic example of no matter how hot your wrestling was, you were never allowed to go to to a public facility and book it because the WWF had that closed down. And I remember – I don't know if he's passed away yet, but Jim Oherst, who ran the Greensboro Coliseum, it was like that with the Crocketts. They had closed it down, and they'd had lawsuits in the 70s over another promotion trying to come to the Winston-Salem Coliseum and the Greensboro Coliseum and not being able to get in, and they sued the Crocketts and the Coliseums. But we had dibs on front row tickets because I forget her last name, but Grandma, who had been going to wrestling for a million years, literally since it started in the 50s in Greensboro, had an in with Jim Oherst and the office. And so they just put aside front row tickets for her, however many she wanted. And we always got them through her. So what I'm trying to say is it's a little more, it was a little more wink, wink, nod, nod going on back then. When there wasn't, you didn't sell tickets through electronic means or anything like that. So they've been closed out. The Crockett's have been closed out of the major arena in Chicago, and this was the time where there was that battle between the battle between WWF trying to stop anybody from encroaching on what they thought, and pay-per-view was just about to get going, and so that was going on. So they would block people from arenas, and the WWF was ruthless about it whenever they could. And so that they were able to find a building on Thanksgiving night in Chicago that was at least a credible building was a victory for the Crocketts in a strange way, also a defeat, but in a strange way a victory.
More on Vince's predatory business practices in just a moment. The other conventional wisdom that has survived for 30 years, Ronnie Garvin as world champion was an unmitigated disaster. It just was not drawing. The crowd liked him, but they did not love him. True or false?
Oh, that's true. I think there were certain, in 30 years later, the idea of taking a loyal employee and giving him a run with a world championship as kind of a gold watch of we appreciate you and you've been a locker room leader and blah, 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 and all that stuff. That's accepted by fans, but there were far less world champions or as far as the NWA, as far as even the AWA, although that was kind of fading away by 87, and in the WWF, it's definitely a modern take to go, now why the hell didn't Paul Orndorff was really good and he was really drawing against Hulk Hogan, why the hell didn't he get a run with the, it's not fair that he didn't get a run with the WWF championship, and like it was plenty fair. The guy that was going to draw all the money was Hulk Hogan, being dominant, and he was looked at as a guy who deserved that championship. Ric Flair was looked at, heel or not, as a guy who deserved that championship and could buy the fans. Ronnie Garvin was the guy, and you could be this guy too, who deserved to challenge for the championship, and fans would root for Ronnie Garvin to beat Ric Flair. But then it was sort of like when the dog chases the car and catches, bark, 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 chasing a car and then catches the car. The car stops. The dog is like, what the hell do I do with this now? And that was the way it was with Ron Garvin. Ron Garvin, a good guy on a quest to win the world title. He's won it. Your story's over. And people just didn't accept it. And then they were trained to think that maybe that Dusty could beat him. They were trained very much to think that Dusty could beat him, that Dusty was better than everybody. And you wouldn't have been surprised, I think, or you wouldn't have been too shocked that Barry Windham won. But that's about it out of that crew. Like Ricky Morton wasn't going to be – I mean, Ricky Morton was really hot a year or two before that. They could draw like crazy, but you knew he wasn't going to win. And so it was really, now he's won and what do you do? And, it was always planned to be, let's just re-coronate Ric Flair. That's what it was about more than it was about. Let's, let's make Ron Garvin our top star, because they didn't. Or let's make Ron Garvin, you know, let's elevate Ron Garvin. They wanted to do that, but really what they wanted to do was just give, you know, give Ric Flair somebody he could work with on Starrcade night that was one of his best opponents. And Ron Garvin, I used to love to go to see Ron Garvin and Ric Flair matches, because they would beat the ever-loving hell out of each other. You could see, you know, and chop and all that, and you could see, like, their chest would be, by the end of the match, you could see the veins, the blood vessels, because they chopped to that raw, coming out in their chest, and they were just, I mean, it was just all action fight. And this was, and by far the best match on this show. I saw my two claims to fame as far as wrestling goes, I think, are I saw Ron Garvin in Greensboro, third from the top, defend the NWA championship. Now, Ric Flair was in the main event, and Dusty Rhodes was in the main event. But Ron Garvin defended against Big Bubba Rogers, who was not even a major, you know, at that point. He was, you know, he was still standing behind Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express.
That was unheard of. That was crazy.
Yeah. And it got the reaction of a Ron Garvin, Big Bubba Rogers match. You know, he became Big Boss Man, but more famous for that. But that would have been on any other show. It was not. It had none of the drama or the, you know, the this is important that the NWA championship had had for years and years. It's probably the least up to that point, the least of the title defenses for an NWA championship going back 30 years from 1987. And then the other one I always claim is in an opening match, saw Sting versus The Undertaker. In the Greensboro Coliseum. So Sting versus Mark Calloway. I have, you know, that ended in like a DQ or something, and, you know, was a nothing match. But, you know, years later, you're just like, Sting and The Undertaker, oh my God. You know, like the dream match that never came to fruition. So, Garvin, you know, and it was really turning Ric Flair even more of a babyface than he was. Ric Flair was, you know, if you've seen the clips on the ESPN 30 for 30 special, all those, you know, was really cool for that time. And Dusty was getting less cool. And the other, you know, Ron Garvin was kind of Barney Rubble as a wrestler. And it was, French Canadian, the thick accent, all that stuff. And so Flair, people were just cheering for Flair. And like, they didn't care whether, and it sort of taught people the beginning of this new WWE ethic, which was the Four Horsemen do whatever it takes to keep the championships, and they get to live this, you know, they get to, you know, party every night and be looked on and dressed to the nines and screw every woman in sight and all that. And guys who are in their 20s, like we were, it was like, who would you rather be? You know, who would you live the fantasy life of? Hugh Hefner or hardworking, you know, common man. It's like, no, let's go for the hedonism.
Yeah, Dan Connor from the Roseanne Show or Archie Bunker. Would you rather be that guy or would you rather be Hugh Hefner?
Yeah, so that was definitely in place there. But yeah, Ron Garvin, and I think, and you know, I noticed like watching this again. The look on Ron Garvin's face going to the cage. I mean, yes. He was always a pro, but he didn't look happy to me.
And, he's a little sour, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a little sour, and he lasted about six more months. He had a long. He was one of the, he was one they counted on in the NWA and Jim Crockett Promotions, and he lasted about six more months, and then Dusty turned him heel, and he just looked at it like, I'm not losing to Dusty Rhodes all over the place. Screw this, and he just quit. You know, it was like, I've seen enough, and that was, yeah, and that. That thing in Chicago, you can understand he was older than Dusty and Flair by a little bit, and you know, very much a veteran and very much been around for, you know, the NWA championship for all those years, and for him to get a crack at it and then be promoted that way had to frustrate the hell out of him.
And then Ron Garvin, you know, make sure to correct my chronology if I'm wrong about this. I think it was the late 80s. I've heard the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller talk about this. Garvin was part of that crew that went opposition and tried to start a promotional war in the Knoxville area, right, later on?
Yeah, he was definitely – it was late 70s.
Late 70s, sorry. This is way after that then, okay.
Yeah, and he was – but, you know, he was like – we're blackballed out of the industry and all that. But the one thing about the blackballs, particularly as wrestling, you know, as the old territory system, as the old NWA system, the monopolies, and they could blackball people. The promoters who got trouble from stars who ran out outlaw or just gave them trouble for whatever reason, they would blackball them. You couldn't get a job. And Garvin was on that list. You know, it was, they never wrote it down, but definitely was on that list for running outlaw in Tennessee for help, for being a major part of that. But when Ole Anderson in Georgia Championship Wrestling was losing money, he needed cheaper talent. He picked up Ronnie Garvin, and Ronnie Garvin showed that he was really good in the ring and effective and all that. And so, you know, the Crockett's picked him up, and that was the end of that. But yeah, he was a guy who wasn't afraid to speak his mind. If he was making good money and doing well, he was happy. But if he thought he was getting screwed, he would, you know, and a lot of wrestlers were like that. You know, that he would go somewhere else or do something else. And he, you know, this was, like I said, this was kind of, this is where he was dissatisfied, even though it's his one, it's his biggest main event in the Crockett promotion. By the way, you know that Ron Garvin flat out in Tennessee beat Andre the Giant one night.
I hadn't heard that story. Was he doing the Hands of Stone gimmick at that time?
They didn't call it that. The Hands of Stone gimmick came from Roberto Duran.
Uh-huh. Like,
you know, correct. Stolen right from that. And of course, one of his major rivals was Boris Malenko. The Malenko stomp became the Garvin stomp, which now Randy Orton uses 30 years later. But, you know, stomp on the ankles, stomp on the hands. And that always looked like just, I mean, always really visually credible. But he was a major star in Tennessee, and Andre the Giant really liked him. And so Andre just said, look, you know, we're going to have this match. And, Garvin was the one-man gang, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
Before the one-man gang was the one-man gang, and the one-man gang took the name from – George Gray took the name from Ronnie Garvin. But Ronnie Garvin, Andre said, I'll put you over. So this is what you're going to do. And he took the Malenko stomp, I believe. And then he also – but, like, he let him body slam him. He let Garvin body slam him, and then he let him pin him. And there was and is footage on this. I don't think there's the whole match that they showed in Tennessee – but Andre just thought, you know, Andre knew that, that Vincent J. McMahon was very protective of his gimmick of being undefeated and all that. And so the deal was, we'll do it in Tennessee. The Tennessee people will see it. It'll really put over Ronnie Garvin, and it did. But no one else will see it, and the magazines will just stay away. You know, the wrestling magazines will just stay away from it, and we'll be fine. And that's pretty much how it worked out. But
I can assume among the other promoters it didn't go over very well, because I've heard about the when Lawler did his thing with Andre the Giant, that was also pretty unpopular among the other promoters.
Well, what was unpopular was that Bill Apter in the Stanley Weston magazines, and I guess The Wrestler, I actually have a copy of this somewhere. Wrote did a headline, The Night a Midget Beat Andre the Giant.
Right.
And it was Jerry Lawler supposedly was this midget because he was short.
Right.
Except not, but, you know, he wasn't – no one in Memphis thought he was short, and so he's short compared to Andre the Giant. But I think he won by countout. I don't think he won by pinning. But, understandably, Vincent K. McMahon was furious because this magazine went all over the country, and it was like, what the hell is this? And so after, you know, got chewed out, even though he didn't work for him, but, you know, it was like access was everything. And then he, you know, they didn't want to be on the bad side of Vincent J. McMahon. They didn't want to be on the bad side of any of the promoters that were making money, because that was where they could sell their those markets would be where they'd sell their magazines. So they had to come back and say write some sort of story about how Andre the Giant destroyed Jerry Lawler or some damn thing. I think the other promoters really didn't know about this, and it didn't make the magazines. I think that was the key. If it didn't make the magazines, they probably didn't like it, but it really was not that big a deal, because
right.
just was not known. You know, if you grew up in – I mean, I never heard it till years and years later. If you grew up in Tennessee and you were watching wrestling then, yeah, it was a big deal. But if you were anywhere else where the television didn't travel, and that television didn't travel, you didn't know.
No matter what kind of wrestling fan you are, Ring Rust Radio is the perfect podcast for you. Every Wednesday night, Ring Rust Radio breaks down the hottest news in professional wrestling, including Raw, SmackDown, and WWE pay-per-view reviews. That isn't all, as Ring Rust Radio also delves into NXT, Lucha Underground, Ring of Honor, Impact Wrestling, and New Japan to discuss the latest happenings in every major company. Ring Rust Radio conducts interviews with the biggest stars in the wrestling business as well, including Stone Cold Steve Austin, Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, Roman Reigns, AJ Styles, Chris Jericho, Kurt Angle, and many more. If you're looking for your wrestling fix with an entertaining twist, check out Ring Rust Radio every week on Blog Talk Radio, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The one of the big angles of 1987, in order to get Ronnie Garvin over, in February, Jim Cornette, at a TV taping in Charlotte, throws a fireball in his face, and it's really effective because the thing stuck to Ronnie Garvin and ended up really singeing his eyebrows and nose hairs and everything else. And it turns out that that angle worked out pretty well because Jim Cornette gets all of these death threats. He's suspended by the NWA so he can go on vacation to Hawaii. But it was a pretty memorable angle for folks in the Carolinas and Virginia back during the day.
It's on the WWE Network. It's a real it reunited the Garvins because the Garvin brothers, Ronnie Garvin was a babyface and Jimmy Garvin was a heel, and they had teamed together. And actually Ronnie Garvin was Jimmy Garvin's stepfather, but they certainly weren't going to say that. And so Jimmy Garvin had turned babyface. Now, he had not turned babyface. Ronnie Garvin had stayed babyface, and Jimmy Garvin was this heel. And so Jimmy Garvin, the brother, you know, the brotherly love of, oh, my God, you know, you threw a fireball. I don't get along with my brother, but that's my brother. So they had the big emotional reunion. And it said something to the credibility of Ronnie Garvin as a tough guy, as the way fans saw him, is that people really did think – people were really intrigued by the idea of Ronnie Garvin going in – against that sissy mama's boy, Jim Cornette, and particularly in the steel cage, and that thing drew. They did real business with that in 86, including there was one show, and it's in that book. I'm trying to think of where it was, but there was one show where I think it may have been Charleston, South Carolina or something, where that was really the only thing on the card was Ronnie Garvin going for revenge in a steel cage against Jim Cornette, and it did big business because people wanted to see Ronnie Garvin kill Jim Cornette. And Cornette, Ronnie Garvin did great determined interviews, you know, coming back from being, you know, burned to death. And Cornette did these great, oh my God, you know, the lawyers are going to get me out of this. The Midnight Express got to get me out of this. No, they're banned from ringside. No, all that stuff. And he had to go in. And, you know, and they did a match, and Cornette was legitimately concerned that because Garvin was such a stiff worker that he beat the hell out of him. And he says in that book that Garvin, that they gave – the fans went crazy and they gave him what they were looking for, but Garvin took really good care of him too. So that was – you know, when you've got your characters over, and I don't – and I'm not even talking about – people believe it's – all real. I mean, I saw, you know, I've seen Baby Doll talk about it. Everybody believed it was real when Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes were wrestling, and it's like, nah, I was there, and they would get pissed and all that, but if you walked out of the arena and said, you know, and just talked to anybody, and I did this at certain times, you know, do you think this is real? Most of the time, they were like, nah, I know it's, you know, or they gave you the old, it's not real until they bleed, and then somehow the switch turns on and it's real. Or the world title is real, and everything else isn't real. But they could, you know, they would get into it emotionally, and while they were into it emotionally, it was real then. And you know, that's what you're looking to do with today's wrestling or anybody else's entertainment. It's like just get you into. I didn't think Thor was really, you know, fighting the Hulk when I went to the movie, but I was into it because I could. I could get into it, and that's what's there. And then you had the people who did believe that it was real. they were there, and you know they were interesting, and maybe you wanted not to sit next to them. So,
I'm going to say that you antagonize those people.
From time to time, yes, we did. We did. If we had somebody who was really mad, I mean, I just remember. Nikita Koloff as a heel versus Ric Flair for the NWA title, and and during this time a few years before, and this guy was like, dirty commie, he's cheating, I've had enough of blah 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 blah. It's like, I've had it, I'm getting in the ring, you guys gonna help me? Yeah, oh yeah, we're right behind you, pal. I tell you what, and you know, and Hitch did this, I tell you what, we'll count down so we all jump the rail together. And so count it down, and we didn't have to like say anything to each other. It was just like count it down, and you know, it was like, you know, jumping off that cliff, and he was the only guy that jumped, and he jumped and went to the ring and grabbed Nikita and around the leg, and Nikita kicked him, and they pulled him not so gently to the concrete floor. The security did, and drug him out, and we were like laughing our heads off. That's what you get. So yeah, that was part of it. But
now this was the first, in addition to the,
like, we got a live one. Here we go. We got a live one.
Of course, that's an MARK. There he is. I got him. He's right there. Yeah. This would be in addition to the closed circuit locations. This was the first time that Starrcade was offered on pay per view, and this would not be like the nice addressable remote control that you have today. I think a couple of cities actually had those. I know in Columbus, Ohio, there was this great experiment with this interactive television all the way back into the early and mid-'80s. But this was the kind of situation where you would have to call up your cable company and go, hey, I want to watch this, I want to order this, and they would put it on your bill, or in some cases you would have to pay for it right there, give them a credit card. But the pay-per-view aspect of this was a real problem for Jim Crockett Promotions. And why was that, Bruce?
Because the WWF blocked them from going to most of the cable systems. And it was a real problem because the Crocketts were bleeding money. And they were making these big moves, these expansions. And they also, to keep their talent, they're starting to sign their talent to big money contracts where if they didn't make the money over the arenas – just by the pay from the arena shows, at the end of the contract, they would have to make this major payment to catch it all up. And so they knew that was coming, and they really looked at it like pay-per-view was going to be their the thing that would save them. And there was interest in, you know, there was interest in seeing Starrcade, but if you couldn't, but there weren't the platforms because WWE was able to go and say, if you go into business with the Crocketts, we're not going to go into business with you. And they had gotten to pay-per-view first. And so it was restraint of trade, but legally it was, you know, legally they were able to get away with it. And it was a major battle, but it was, I remember, you know, I was insider fan reading the Observer at this point and all that. And I remember just like, that was a big deal. And you thought that like Starrcade was going to make things better. And because they were closed off, because the Crocketts were closed off from platforms to sell their product, it didn't. They didn't get the money in that they thought they would have.
So tell me about the UWF and the expansion there, because we see the UWF and a couple of the belts featured during this Starrcade 87.
Yeah. I remembered one really well, and I'd forgotten about another part of that. But the UWF had come out of Mid-South Wrestling, Bill Watts' company, and Bill Watts had made a decision, and I think everybody, I mean rightfully so, that if he was going to survive, that if he was going to if he was going to keep his company, he couldn't stay in that one territory and get his talent picked apart by the WWF and by the Crocketts. You had to go national and make the world your territory. And so he made that decision and created, instead of calling it Mid-South Sports, Mid-South Wrestling, called it the Universal Wrestling Federation, because as we all know, the universe is bigger than the world. Mm-hmm. He was late getting there, but he had a great syndication network because of all the wrestling shows back in the 80s, the one that was the best to watch episodically with the most exciting things happening, to the point where sometimes the television was better than the house shows, was Mid-South. And same thing with the UWF. So you know, they had the Freebirds and Ted DiBiase and they had lost Junkyard Dog, but they had Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Skandar Akbar and the One Man Gang and Missy Hyatt and Dark Journey and Dick Slater and a lot of different and the beginnings of Sting and some of the Ultimate Warrior and the Ultimate Warrior and all that, but he wasn't called the Ultimate Warrior then. But so they were great shows to watch, but they weren't doing well at the arenas. And part of the problem was the core territory was the old business just imploded at that time. And so there wasn't a lot of money in the home territory, and then they had spread themselves. And so Watts was just like, I want to get out of this business, because this was, you know, the idea that you ran a wrestling business, that you ran a wrestling promotion because you loved and had a passion for wrestling, and it was your social, you know, your social circle, and you just wanted to keep afloat so that you could continue to be in the wrestling business. That was very much a new thing in the last 25 years. Most wrestling promoters, they just wanted to make money, and they were willing, they're pretty ruthless about it too, and they just saw wrestling as a way to do that. So Watts was like, I got to get out of this business. This is not working out. And so Jim Ross kind of worked his way with the Crockett's and contacted them and said, you know, do you want to buy, I think it was an airplane, and would you like to buy this plane or something from Bill Watts? And they were like, but if he's willing to sell the whole thing for a certain price, and kind of lured the Crockett's in, just canny businessmen. I'm not saying this was a ripoff. And the Crockett's were interested mostly in the syndicated network that the UWF, that Watts had built up, Watts and Jim Ross had built up across the country, because they felt like if they could marry their syndicated network, and syndication was the hour-long shows that were usually on Saturdays, sometimes on Sundays, and sometimes on the week, on UHF stations, on the weaker stations, and get advertising money from that and make television pay, and then be all across the country, saturated across the country, then that was where they felt like they weren't battling on a place where they weren't battling on an even keel with the WWF. The WWF had a stronger syndicated network, but that would make them with one fell swoop, the Crockett's, a bigger syndicated network than the WWF. And so they bought the company, and that also meant that the talent, if they wanted to, and if Jim Crockett Promotions wanted them, would go with the Crockett. So you had Dr. Death Steve Williams, and you had the Freebirds, and you had this really good talent base, but a lot of them working in Japan as their main place to work. And you know, Ted DiBiase had the choice of do I go to Charlotte and work for the Crockett's in Jim Crockett Promotion, or do I try this new character that I'm hearing about that Vince McMahon has for me? And if there's ever, you know, there's a lot of like, what if this and what if that, but if there's ever anybody who made the right choice in life, yeah, at a point, it was, it was Ted DiBiase.
That kind of worked out for him.
Yeah, that worked out for him. It's like, I think he realized as soon as he was told by Pat Patterson that really that, Vince McMahon wanted Ted DiBiase to play Vince McMahon, the Million Dollar Man. Exactly. He was like, "No, I'm in." Who cares about who cares about beating Ric Flair for the NWA title, whatever the rest of this is? It's like, yeah, this is going to make a lot of money. And so,
well, as we record this, you know, the Ted DiBiase has been making a lot of appearances to promote that movie of his. I think it's called The Price of Fame. And he's very explicit about saying, look, they wouldn't tell me what the character was until I committed to doing it, because it was the secret sauce. And as you say, Pat Patterson goes, look, I can't tell you, but if Vince could be a character on his own TV show, this would be what he would be. And Ted DiBiase bit hook, line, and sinker, and as you say, the rest is history.
Right. So, and that's right. It was secret sauce. They didn't want anybody to know. And there was – I remember there was little rumblings about what would happen with DiBiase, but and a big one was that he's on this show was Doc, was Dr. Death Steve Williams. But – It was the idea in wrestling fans' minds and particularly insider fans' minds of, oh my God, you can book you know, no one thought Invasion, although they would have, we would have loved that, you know, the UWF guys would have just come and done that angle we've seen so many times, and so many times on wrestling shows in the years since then. But no one had done it like that, you know, like another company came in and beat up everybody. But they just thought, look at all the great matchups. Look at all, you know, Eddie Gilbert and Terry Taylor. Look at all these guys that you can really do something with to freshen up the Crockett's, to freshen up the Four Horsemen. And, you know, will Ric Flair turn babyface? And will, you know, what about, you know, getting some new opponents for the Midnight Express? And the Rock and Roll Express are kind of, you know, winding down their boy band era, and so it was like some fresh matchups, some fresh talent, and Dr. Death Steve Williams versus Ric Flair,
yeah,
the NWA title, and do a title versus title situation, and you know, Dr. Death was at that time considered legitimately the toughest guy maybe in the world, because there wasn't a mixed martial arts, but definitely in you know, in North American professional wrestling. And so, God, let's see him against Ric Flair. And, you know, you knew Ric Flair could have a good match with anybody. And Doc worked hard and was a good wrestler. So it was like, let's see that. That'd be great. And but what Dusty Rhodes was protecting his position, so he didn't want to have competition for that top babyface slot. But also, he had this cadre of talent that he would fight with, but he was loyal to, and he just looked at it the way Vince McMahon would look at it, which was let's bring these guys in and prove that we were the better wrestling all along, and that's how we'll book it. And it very much, and you know, for fans didn't care about the syndication network. They you know, they want, you know, those of us that were fans of the Crockett's above the WWF, fans of the wrestlers that were there in the style, and you know, weren't into, as you said, family wrestling, or really what we thought of as children's wrestling, kiddie wrestling, that we were about the talent, how that was going to some of these really good wrestlers, how that was going to help and, you know, make the shows better and more exciting. And we didn't much care about the syndication and that, and the talent coming in. This was about the end of the UWF's talent coming in. It was a flop. I mean, they just didn't do anything with them. And we should get into the matches, because boy, did they make that clear that the Crockett's were the better, you know, the Crockett wrestlers were the better wrestlers, and they cut off their nose, you know, and Jim Crockett Promotions cut off their nose to spite their face. But I don't know that if they've used the talent better, that would have been a key to, you know, and this was where you had to win, to the Crockett's beating the WWF, to the, you know, being the national promotion. And but this was a major expense. They ended up, and this was a major expense for the time that the Crockett's lasted. But it also, they ended up not paying Bill Watts anywhere near, you know, anywhere near what they owed him. And as far as like the deal was, because they were, you know, they all of a sudden, you know, they did not expand their business. WWF did not expand their business. Not WWF.
The Jim Crockett Promotions.
Jim Crockett Promotions didn't expand just the business structure of how many accountants and how many people working merchandising and all that. And they needed to. They ran it kind of out of an office, and their accountant got overwhelmed, whether it was his fault or not. He got overwhelmed with all the money and all the money that was going out, the money coming in. And then
one day they open up the books and there's none there. They're in the red. They ain't got no money.
And Dusty Rhodes believed in going, like Vincent Mann in certain ways, believed in going all out. But unlike Vincent Mann, he had no discipline with it. It was like, you know, he didn't care. It's just like, let me talk Jimmy into doing this, buying me this plane. Let me, you know, so that this private plane, so I can fly like a rock star.
Fly from Charlotte to Spartanburg.
The famous story of flying from Charlotte to Spartanburg, which is an hour drive, you know, so you're like, you know, and how expensive that was. But the expenses were mounting up, and the revenues were constricting by the time of the show. And like I said, to me, it really stood out to me watching the show that, like, boy, this is the beginning. This really is the beginning of the end in certain ways.
But also, this would be the period of time where the Crockett's were looking to move to Dallas to expand and to not only do wrestling, but they also wanted to do motion pictures and maybe TV shows and just be a huge multimedia company.
We know you're a pro wrestling fan, but you might like MMA too. And if so, check out our sister site, MMATorch.com, with live fight event coverage, including UFC pay-per-views, previews of all UFC and Bellator events, the daily news digest, exclusive columns, flashbacks, and much more. Check it out. If you're a fan of MMA, you'll be a fan of MMATorch.com.
You know, the JCP network, streaming network, Dusty had those ideas of the movies too, the idea that Magnum TA was going to be a movie star and he would be, and Dusty would be, another version of John Wayne and, as the older, but heroic Western character and all that. And, that was scoffed at. I always took the move to Dallas as more of a slap in the face than anything. Because I was like, this is a North Carolina business, and as a North Carolina native like you are, I was like, there's plenty here. There's no why are you doing that? Oh, the airports are better in Dallas, but it was again they bought this building, it was more expensive, and they wanted wrestlers to move to Dallas, which never really happened, and now I look at it like, the WWF. Hulk Hogan, Rock and Wrestling, and WrestleMania caught fire at the right time to expand. They had the right plan creatively to go along with the expansion. Vince McMahon did. And, it came really close, but he was able to generate enough revenue to keep that moving, where the Crocketts had their great creative time that got them a lot of money in 1985, when Dusty came in and first started booking, brought in his talent crew and got everything set up, and it was really hot. But by the time they were expanding, it was not hot. You needed to be hot to expand, and they weren't. The business wasn't hot enough for the Crocketts, and so the expenses of expanding, all the different big moves they made, they couldn't afford. And they couldn't get their business built up. And part of it was they stayed with that pat hand of Mr. Rhodes, booking and being the number one star that needed to be changed. And they had, they came close in certain ways, but they ran out of time, they ran out of money, and they weren't the business people that the WWF, the Vince McMahon and the WWF structure were.
In a way, it's almost like the Jim Crockett Promotions guys, the senior staff, really bought into that TV show Dallas, of all the glamour and the money and the lifestyle and the fashion and the women and stuff. And guys, it's a TV show, but it's a work. So the idea, the irony of a wrestling promoter falling for a work of a television show is not lost, I don't think, on anyone. Tell me about TWN.
It's worth saying that Jim Crockett Promotions, that Jim Crockett still lives in Texas, still lives in Dallas. Now you could be the Crockett family could be a big deal, and they were in Charlotte, North Carolina, but with those Ullman and the real ones in Texas and in Dallas, I don't care how big they got. Vincent Mann wasn't going to be Vincent Mann made it to billionaire status. I guess he could have been one, but they were going to be, they weren't going to compete with those Ullman, and as far as like being big shots in a major market. The TWN was the wrestling network, which was the syndicated network of all these different shows, including keeping the name of the UWF show and then just providing Crockett content for it with a little bit difference of having Big Bubba Rogers be the UWF champion and beat the One Man Gang to set up Dr. Death Steve Williams beating him and to have a little bit of original program, but really making it another Crockett show. But that was the syndicated network they had all over the place.
And that was supposed to counter Vince's domination of everything, really, at that time.
And I can tell you, just nobody cared. The fans look like, hey, look, on the banner it says TWN. Why didn't it say NWA? And if you read the Observer, and the Torch was, I think, starting in this year. If you read the Observer, you knew. But what the Wrestling Network? Who cares? It's so that was kind of part of it.
It does bear repeating. The syndication was a huge part of the pie back then, and it was seen as a way to kind of counter the growing monolith that was cable television. The only way you could really battle. But things were changing so rapidly when it came to the television product. And it's interesting to see now, in the 21st century, as cable reached max penetration, and now so many people every month, thousands and thousands and thousands of people, millions every year, are cutting the cord and getting away from cable television. And now the main distribution, eventually the main distribution for television, is going to be the internet. More people are going to watch stuff on the internet than they do on cable or over the air in a matter of just a couple of years. So it's interesting to think about 1987 as it related to that.
Right. And you know, the changes in wrestling, we were all up in arms about the changes in wrestling then. You know, like, but wrestling is always changing, always evolving, and it is always evolving in step with, if it's going to be successful, in step with technology, with whatever media platforms they can use, whether it's just newspapers and newspaper ads, or TV studio wrestling, or radio, or syndicated, you know, over the air stations and cable and cable superstations, or what, you know, all the way to streaming networks and all the things and all the ways people watch today. You have to keep up. You have to change, and the wrestling has to change too. But it's always like, you know, I think you're always like thinking, why isn't it good like in this era, in the Attitude Era, in the 70s, in the 50s, and the, what, you know, in the 50s it was the major television product, you know, professional wrestling. So there's all, you know, that's always going on.
And it's interesting also when you talk about that today, since they've been able to catalog these things and you can easily watch them whenever you want to, that we're being told today, oh, the Attitude Era was so much better. It's so much greater. Everything was better. But back in 85, we weren't being told that, what, 1979 was so awesome. They weren't showing clips from 78 and telling you, oh, this was so much better. It's never going to be like that again. You know, there was never that comparison.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. I mean, I always think of – yeah, I think of like in – you know, in 1985, well, 30 years before that was 1955, and that was even before I was born. But, you know, or they talk, you know, the idea that they come on and go, yeah, you know, the Rock and Roll Express are really good, but George and what's it, not Boris Becker, but George and Bruce Becker, as a matter of fact, the late Bruce Becker, you know, the Becker brothers, man, you should have seen them. It's like, you never heard any of that stuff. And, you know, there's a throwback on the, you know, we'll talk about Johnny Weaver, but Johnny Weaver, you didn't get like, he was the number one babyface in the territory, in the number one babyface tag team, challenging for the world's title. It was just, here's, you know, here's Johnny Weaver, the ever popular announcer, who was a former, you know, was a really good former wrestler, and now he's involved in this storyline. That's all, you know, and that's what that was about. What you did, yeah, it's amazing to think of. You know, 30 years before, it's like, why are you, you know, what are you talking about that? But definitely, you know, the draw on the local house show, and you know, on the anniversary, the 30th anniversary of this show is Ric Flair. That's the truth. So
the night before they head to Chicago on the 25th of November, they are in Nassau, Long Island at the Nassau Coliseum, which I think every worker who has ever talks about what a horrible place that was to work in terms of the locker room and just the sound and just an awful building. They did War Games and they drew $126,000, 10,000 people paying $126,000 into Vince McMahon's backyard. So they could not resist going into Vince McMahon's backyard and tweaking his nose just a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's hilarious. So, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, you're just like, they, you know, they were trying to do that and they went to Nassau and, you know, the Bunkhouse Stampede, their Jim Crockett's first pay-per-view, was such a flop and blocked from everywhere and such a flop of a show because the wrong talent, Dusty Rhodes, who was not as – had been big in that area but wasn't after a few years later, and just, you know, instead of – they really should have been pushing something else, but they did the corn pone, you know, we're going to have a Bunkhouse Stampede, come around, gather around the fire, and that would work here, and that would work in Florida and certain in Texas and certain places, but in Nassau, in New York City. So I did see a show there years later, Yeah, it was a place.
Was there a smell of sweat and urine as there was at the old Philadelphia Spectrum?
I don't remember it being quite like that, but I remember it being kind of a, you know, it was one of those buildings that was probably outmoded the minute it opened. So, you know,
I'm a huge fan of Pearl Jam, and they played the last couple of shows at the Spectrum, and Eddie Vedder is on stage just waxing poetic and how he wishes they wouldn't tear it down. And I'm looking around going, geez, this place should have been torn down years ago. And in true Philadelphia fashion, I think it took them like 2 or 2.5 years before they even got the money together to raise the place.
Right, yeah.
So I think the Nassau Coliseum is probably right along the same lines as that. We take you to 525 South Racine Avenue in Chicago, Illinois. That is the University of Illinois Chicago Pavilion, the UIC Pavilion, which seats 9,500 people for boxing and wrestling. It was opened in 1982 at a construction cost of $10 million. I'm sure that's much more than $25 million in today's dollars. And it is Starrcade 87, Chi-Town Heat, with that main event we told you about earlier. Hands of Stone, Ronnie Garvin defending his NWA World Heavyweight Championship against the former champion, the Nature Boy, Ric Flair. We are told by Mr. Cornette from the scrapbook that this was a sellout, drawing $180,000. And we're also told that this was the fourth consecutive sellout at the UIC Pavilion. So for any criticism of the building, they did continue to sell it out time after time after time after time, at least in 1987.
And it was so interesting why what got credit for the sellouts in Chicago, and that was the Road Warriors. The Road Warriors, you know, these two bouncers out of Minneapolis, Minnesota.
That's correct.
Were seen as hometown Chicago tough guys.
Now, can you explain to me how that happened? Because I was going to ask you that. I didn't want to sound like a dummy, but I how did they get associated with Chicago?
Because Ole Anderson, when he came up with the gimmick with help from Bill Watts and from Eddie Sharkey, when he came up with the gimmick, he wanted to like portray that these two guys were tough guys. They didn't give real hometowns most of the time. As it turned out, Mick Foley was not. I mean, Cactus Jack Manson was not from Truth or Consequences, New Mexico.
Right.
And Dutch Mantel was not from Old Trough, Texas. They may not even have been in Old Trough, Texas. And so most of them had hometowns that fit their gimmicks. And, you know, Ric Flair, when he was a heel here, was announced from Minneapolis because that's where he was from. But going around the country, he was announced from Charlotte, North Carolina. And so that was part of it. So the idea was that the Road Warriors were from the tough streets of Chicago, because nobody believes in any tough streets in Minneapolis, even though there probably are some. And there was much, you know, Chicago has that gangster reputation from years ago and you know, the tough streets of Chicago. And now, you know, now, of course, it's part of our, you know, supposedly everybody gets murdered in Chicago, even though they have these great gun control laws. And so it had that image. And so they just announced it over and over again during the time, you know, when they were going national and touring all the territories, because they were such a big special attraction from Chicago. When they're in the AWA, from Chicago, even in the Minneapolis area, from Chicago, they were booked as heels. Everywhere they went, Chicago, 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 and that got over in Chicago. Hey, we'll take these guys. And they were looked at as the toughest, you know, like the tag team. They were the toughest, baddest tag team. They're probably the last big national tag team, you know, the last big real draw as a tag team across the country in main events. And so when the Crockett's went to Chicago, you had these people who've been watching for a couple of years if they weren't watching syndication, they were watching on WTBS on the 605 World Championship Wrestling Show on Saturday nights. And like, oh my God, we get to see our guys, the Road Warriors. And so that sold out, and it sold out, and it sold out until the last sellout, Starrcade. And when we get to that match, we'll talk about that.
All right, we're at the midway point of this great discussion with Bruce and Britt. If you want to hear the second half of this discussion on Starrcade 87, be sure to go VIP, because that's where you can find the entire show in the Bruce Mitchell Audio Show section. That is pwtorch.com/govip. That's where you go to sign up. Just takes a minute or two to become a VIP member. We'd love to have your support, and I think you'll really appreciate the content that we work tirelessly to deliver to you. You have such a great selection of next level, top shelf pro wrestling coverage, including new VIP exclusive podcasts every day, and these live casts, which go ad free. That's pwtorch.com/govip. Catch me 4 days a week on my new home over at Podcast One, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, available just by searching Wade Keller in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to pro wrestling podcasts. You can also find links to our shows at our main page, pwtorch.com. Thanks so much, everybody. And now we'll jump to a sign-off from Brett Whitmire, who will talk about how you can follow him on social media. Thanks to Britt for guest hosting this edition of the Bruce Mitchell Audio Show. And I was pleased to be able to bring you the first half of this interview for free here at the PW Torch Livecast.
You can follow me on Twitter, at Britt Whitmire. Our show is followable at Katie Vick Alive. If you'd like to do that, I'm also on Instagram, at BDub4Reels, B-D-U-B, number 4, R-E-E-L-Z. And thank you so much for listening.
PW Torch Livecast listeners, I invite you to get even more of what the Torch offers by becoming a PW Torch VIP member. Not only do you get ad-free access to our website, the mobile site, and the desktop site, and access to about 30 years of our archives, including over 1,500 back issues and thousands upon thousands of hours of our audio shows going back to 2004, plus tons of retro radio shows from the 1990s, but you also get over 15 VIP exclusive podcasts per week, in addition to ad-free editions of these PW Torch livecasts throughout the week. So we take the ads out of the PW Torch livecast for VIP members and then give you over 15 other podcasts per week, including what started it all, the Bruce Mitchell Audio Show. I host that with Bruce every weekend, and we spend a couple hours talking about the biggest stories of professional wrestling and wrestling history. It's one of the longest-running weekly pro wrestling podcasts on any subject. And it's one of the main reasons people go VIP and stay VIP. Another is The Fix with Todd Martin. I host that every midweek with Todd, and we get Todd's expertise and opinions every midweek on current events in professional wrestling, not just WWE, but all promotions worldwide, including New Japan. Plus, we end every show with some expert MMA talk from the LA Times columnist and SureDog contributor, Todd Martin. And there's so much more. The Every Single Day Weight Cover Hotline with news updates every single day, Monday through Friday. And every Saturday and Sunday, I do the SE Editor format of the Weight Cover Hotline, where I answer VIP member questions in depth. And there's so much more. There's the Wayback Playback with Pat McNeil and Jim Valley, Wrestling Audio Community with Sean Radican, the WWE Future Past Show with scouting reports on prospects and a look back at the indie career of current stars, the PW Torch East Coast Cast Extended VIP Edition, the retro radio shows. Every Thursday, a new retro radio show from the 90s drops, from the early 90s or the Attitude Era. And last but not least, my in-depth Raw and SmackDown reports. You can get a full chronological rundown of every episode of Raw and SmackDown with my analysis of the show in-depth every Monday night and Tuesday night. So check out details at pwtorch.com/govip. We give you a lot here at the livecast, but there is so much more. The vast majority of our work is for our VIP members, and you can become one today. Go check out details on a subscription at pwtorch.com/govip.